Tradition 6, I ought not overly invest myself in other spiritual, emotional, or physical growth, lest problems of ego gratification divert me from my primary purpose. This is a tricky place, especially if you have children. But I do know where the line is these days, although a lot of times that's not until I've crossed over it. I heard a speaker say one time, he said, if you want to do something but you don't know whether it's loving kindness or enabling, go ahead and do it. He thought he was talking to a room full of alcoholics. He didn't know we'd kind of slipped in there. And he said, if afterwards you feel screwed, it was enabling. Well, what I know is if I do something and afterwards I feel victimized in any way, angry or sorry for myself or any of that, it was enabling. And what I was enabling was my own, I was enabling myself. I was doing what I was doing to make me feel better. And not out of being of service. I was doing it, enabling my own self-serving behavior. That's what I was enabling. Early on, I heard about detachment. And when it finally happened to me, and you can't, I don't believe, make detachment happen. I believe detachment is a byproduct of working on your own life. It was the only reason I could do it was to either keep me alive or not screw up their lives. My sponsor said, it's the Hippocratic Oath, honey. Every day you say to yourself, at least I'll do no harm. You know, at least let me do no harm. Heaven knows there's still a lot of times when I don't know what's mine, whether this is mine to do or it's not mine to do. It's one of the myriad reasons I have a loving sponsor, someone who can hear me and give me sound perspective. And I'll say, does this sound like healthy behavior? I have a dear friend who's been my dear friend in this program for since she's been in 6 months longer than I have. But through all these years, when I've had an issue with my children for whatever reason, no matter what sponsor I had, she was the one I would call. A couple of months ago, I called her and I said, I'm getting ready to do something. And I need to know if this sounds like healthy behavior to you, because I'm not sure if this is mine to do or not. My son-in-law and my daughter have been having a lot of trouble. And I've managed to stay right out of that. I take care of their little children every day and try to provide the consistency that isn't happening because they're having a lot of trouble. And my son-in-law was in jail. He'd gotten himself picked up for speeding, and they found an old ticket he hadn't dealt with for 3 years, and it was like $800 to get him out of jail. And my daughter was of a mind to leave him there until it was convenient to go get him. And it wasn't going to be convenient. He was in jail like 45, 50 miles away from where she was, and it would mean she'd have to go take their savings out of the bank and go, or I could go get him. Now, first off, I want to tell you, this is what my daughter said to me when I said, won't you just let me go get him? She said, you never got me out of jail. I said, right. And if this is you, I'd probably leave you there. But this isn't you. This is him. And what's happening with him is affecting you and affecting my grandchildren. And it feels like mine to do. And besides, I think it would be a lot more effective if his mother-in-law picked him up rather than his wife, which is exactly what the keeper at the jail told me. He said, I hope you're the mother-in-law and not the mother. I said, I am. He said, good. But I called my friend and I said, is this mine to do or not mine to do? Does this sound like healthy behavior? She said, you know what? Sometimes stuff happens. And it isn't about 12 steps, and it's not about traditions, and it's not about recovery. It's about mom stuff. You got to make a mom decision here. What kind of mom are you? Is this the kind of mother you want to be? And I wasn't being his mother. I was being my daughter's mother. And I was being my grandchildren's grandmother. That's what I was being. And I took the money to the jail and got his pajama-clad little body out of the jail. And I had gotten $800 out, and I think it was like $720 to get him out, and there was like $80 left over. And I said, I don't know where your car is. I know it's been impounded in some other little town. And I said, I don't have time to get your car today. That's going to be yours. Here's the $80 that's left over, so now you owe me a rounded $800. And I said, this is money you owe me. Melissa doesn't owe me this money. You owe the money, and I expect you to pay it back. Now, having said that, I also know when you give money to kids, it's got to be a gift. You know, yeah, I said that. And I have every intention of saying good job when he pays me. But if he doesn't, I knew it when I gave it to him, you know. I have been a mother a long time. And I have learned some things. Today, this tradition is my guide more often than not, living in my own body behind my belly button, doing my own part so I can stay on track with God, keeping my focus on my source and not on them. Trusting God and loving the people and not the other way around. If you trust the people and just love God, you're going to get slapped in the face on a regular basis. But if you trust God and keep, if that's where my focus is, and love the people, oh, life is a joy. It is a joy. I have all my life had a hard time going into shopping malls. It is way overwhelming to me. I have trouble in the parking lot. Forget getting into the mall. My sponsor and I one time were talking together down in Arizona, and there was a mall across the street, and she's a shopper. And she said, come on, she calls me baby sister. Come on, baby sister, let's go to the mall. I said, no, I can't go to the mall. She said, you can go with me. And she let me hook my finger through her back belt loop, and I followed her through the mall. And I know what the issue is. For whatever reason, whether it's because I grew up in alcoholism or just because I'm the way I was made to be, I have a tendency to live on the edge of my fingers. I walk in a room and I want to test and see where the safe places are, who the safe people are, where the anger is so I can stay away from it, where the drunks are so I can either run to them, depending on how I'm feeling at the moment, you know, or run away from them. And that's where I live, is on the edge of my fingers. If you go through a mall, like at holiday time, people are stepping on your feelings all through the mall. I'm just like this open sore going through the mall. And my sponsor said to me, breathe in and go behind that belly button. That's where you live. You don't live out here. You live behind your belly button. And when I remember, I have these sponsees who call me and say, I've got to go home with my family now. I don't think I can do this. And I'll say, just remember where you live. You live behind your belly button. And it's amazing when I take a breath and go back behind my belly button, what they do is not nearly as effective on me as it used to be. Now, and I need to say this for those of you who are at your first or second or third meeting. There's a universal law of change, spiritual law of change. When you change your behavior, everything around you has to change. And they don't want to. It wasn't their idea. When you change, you have these newcomers who come to meetings and they say, this isn't working. He's worse than ever. And we go, yay. It's a good sign. Because he's doing his old behavior harder. Trying to get you to go back to do what it is you used to do so we could get back in that familiar relationship. So when your relationships, when you start to change how you behave in relationships, other people may be uncomfortable with that. That comes under the heading of their problem. And that's so lovely to have that little compartment where you can put things. Their problem. All right. When I try to be many things in a relationship, what feelings are motivating me? None of them are good, I can tell you. How does one become spiritually dependent upon another? Well, I'll tell you one thing, sometimes you can do it in an instant and sometimes it takes years to do. Do I allow others the dignity to succeed or fail emotionally, physically, spiritually without trying to save them or to claim their success? Do I recognize and honor the fact that other adult human beings are not my responsibility? The ODAT rules, you know. Do I encourage and support others but avoid directing them even if they ask me to? It's very tempting, isn't it? It's very tempting. And I'll tell you what, those people in our lives that we've told what to do for so many years, they're going to come back and ask you what to do. What do I do? My children and I have, when I started being able to practice this with them, because they are about to turn 30-something and then 2 years older than 30-something. they would come to me. The first time my daughter called in, she gave me this whole blah, 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 thing, you know, like that, the drama. Blah, 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 blah. And I went, oh, my God, well, I think you should, you know, and I did all the helpful things mothers do. And she said, because she had some recovery, she said, I didn't call you for answers. I just called you to listen. That was my lesson number one. That was a sign from her that she really didn't need me to fix her. She really just needed me to listen. And that's hard to do when you love somebody. But it's the most loving thing you can do. Today, my son will call sometimes with something that's going on. One time he called, this was several years ago, and he and his wife were having this huge fight, and she'd done some terrible thing, which I don't know what it was because it wasn't my business and I didn't ask. But he called and he said, Mom, I don't know what to do. He said, if I call Dad, he's going to tell me to leave her. If I tell my friends, they're going to tell me to leave her. And she said, maybe I should call you. And I said, you know why she told you to call me? Because she knows I'm not going to tell you to leave her. That's why she said that. And you know why you called me? Because you don't want to leave her. He went, oh. I said, there. The rest is your problem. And I said, and I told him, and you know, I do this. I love doing this. It is such a fabulous way to feel about my children. I will tell them, you have such wonderful tools. You are so capable that I know that you know how to ask for help. You can handle whatever comes along. That's what I tell them rather than giving them direction. You can do this, and I'm on your side, and I'll support you in any way I can. How do I feel when someone declines my help? Can I remember that giving is a feeling of control and receiving is a feeling of powerlessness? Do I know where the line is? This is a tricky one. And we had a lot of debate in our little group about this because people did not want to think that giving was control. They wanted to think that giving was just sacrifice, you know. But that's not true. When you give, it's a power thing that happens, whether the other person knows it's happening or not. What we will do in our diseasiness is somebody will say, oh, thank you, and we'll go, oh, it was nothing. And we'll try to minimize, try to make nothing of it. But the fact is we've given something, and we need to allow them to receive. You're welcome. One of the things that I catch myself doing still to this day is someone will say, oh, thank you, and I'll go, oh, no, thank you. I've taken the control one more time. You're welcome is all that's necessary. I don't have to take the power one more time. It's another one of those places that I don't always know where the line is till I cross it. You know, but that's why this is a process. That's why I keep going to meetings. You know, if these steps and the traditions were mechanical, you could do them one time and be done. But they're not mechanical. We are not mechanical people. This is not a mechanical planet. This is not a mechanical spirit. It's a growing and changing and evolving, and I want to be part of it. I don't want to just sit on the sidelines and watch anymore. Seven says, let me see if this is all we got to do is seven.
Yes.
Seven says, I should strive to be self-supporting spiritually, emotionally, financially, and physically, declining offers for others to run my life. This is how I stay autonomous and how I continue to grow to be the best me. It reminds me that I have to make my own decisions about my life. Others will have all sorts of contributions to offer, but only I am responsible for me. Their suggestions or directions or mandates are still just contributions which I can adopt or decline. I have to decide what my needs are and see that they are met. That's my responsibility to myself. I should do that. But sometimes it's really easy, and this is another one of my sponsees' words, to abdicate my responsibility for myself and let someone else's feelings, opinions, judgments lead the way. I take their advice and then I want to give them the blame when it doesn't turn out so hot. The truth remains that I'm making that choice to give someone else the power in my life, and if it goes awry, I can't get out of taking responsibility for my decision. So since I can't avoid the responsibility, I might as well make the decision in the first place. It's just like this. This is just like it was for me in early on in Al-Anon. I had, you know, we had the slogan that says, live and let live. Couldn't do it. I had to do let live and live. And the fact that this sixth tradition, six, comes before this tradition is another one of those places where I have to learn to let them alone and be me before I can be me, before I can do the things that I have to do to be responsible for me. Another B word that comes to mind here is boundaries. My own regarding what I will accept and what I will deliver. And those are really the only boundaries I can set. There's a fabulous page in Courage to Change that was the biggest light bulb for me when I read that, that talked about the boundaries are for me, they're not for you. I set the boundaries about what I will accept and what I will deliver. It's a tricky place, too, for those of us who sometimes feel like someone else's paycheck meets the financial bills in our home. For a good number of years before Dick and I got married, for about, I don't know how many years, for a lot of years, I supported myself and two children. The job I've done for the last 6.5 years barely pays for itself, much less me. And I'm grateful my husband has a good job and he brings home so much bacon and he's happy to have me out of a 9-to-5 job. The truth is I've taken some responsibilities on at home that he doesn't have to do because I'm there. I had him read this through when I did it the first time and he had written in the margin and Dick is very grateful for that too. I thought I should leave that there. He said it. He really is. Which in itself is a real job. You know, I'm doing stuff at home. And I know that if I had to, I could support myself financially. I know I could. I don't want to. But I could if I had to. And that's the issue. I need to know that. Do I take responsibility for my own physical needs? Health? Diet, exercise, teeth, etc. Do I take the action required? We are not good at this. We are not. I had breast cancer 20 years ago that next month, so she recovered. You don't have to worry about it. One of the things I did differently was because I'd been in Al-Anon a couple of years at that point, I knew when I found the lump that I had the responsibility to take action. The old me would never have noticed the lump. You know how an Al-Anon survives in hell? She says, it's not hot and I'm not here. And we are, a number of us are particularly good at that when it comes to physically taking care of ourselves. And let me tell you, the older you get, the more there is to tend to. It is not for wimps. Growing older is not for wimps, but it's my responsibility. I tell this little body all the time, okay, okay, okay. You need to go to the dentist, okay, okay, okay. It doesn't mean I go cheerfully, but I do what I'm supposed to do. And the other thing we do is we set these impossible goals for ourselves. And we say, well, I just don't exercise. I just don't know why I don't. I just can't talk myself into doing it. I'm just not doing it. Because we have this idea in our head that if I'm not going to the gym every day working out for an hour with Mr. Goodbody, I'm not doing it right. So I don't do anything. Hello? The worst thing that happens in those situations, do you know what the highest form of self-abuse is? Perfectionism. And do you know what? We're really not perfectionists. We're really imperfectionists. We don't look for the places where it's perfect. We look for the places where it's imperfect. We look for the places that don't match what we think it ought to look like. That is the highest form of self-abuse. So I made a deal with me. I said, okay, looky here, girlfriend. You can get down on the floor and do 5 minutes of kicking your legs. You can go for a 30-minute walk. You can pull out one of them 20-minute yoga tapes and get a nap at the end of it. If you will just pick one thing to do every day, we can call that exercise. All right. I can handle that, you know. I can do that. It takes me, and I don't do it every day, but I do it most days. Most days. I will do something I can call exercise. I walked this morning in the fog. Not very fast, not very far. But I walked in the fog. I had a lovely time. I'll call that exercise. Okay. And because the worst thing that happens is how I beat myself up about it. That's the worst thing that happens, is beating myself up over and over again. That's my old pattern, is to set myself up for ways to beat myself up because what I'm really afraid is true about me must be true, that I can't take care of myself. I'm not responsible enough. I can't do it. I can take care of you. I just can't take care of me. I try really hard not to set myself up for those moments anymore. Do I pretend to agree with others to keep things smooth and peaceful? Am I taking responsibility for my feelings or their feelings or no one's feelings? How much do I still ask or expect others to fill my emotional needs? Could I take care of myself financially if I had to today? Can I allow people to enhance my life without depending on them to be my whole life? Can I offer support for others and still take care of myself? How am I making sure my spiritual needs are met? That's another one of those places. Well, I don't meditate, you know. I just can't sit still. My mind just won't be quiet. I pray in the car kind of mostly, you know. That's, you hear people doing that, you know. Well, I don't go to church, you know. And you know the minute you hear them say, you can tell by the attitude, oh, I don't go to church. They really think they should be going to church. The should word, a little warning about the should word. My sponsor said one time, she said, you know, every time you say should, I want to ask you, whose rule book are you playing by and who's going to punish you if you break the rules? Should is not about what I want to do. It's about what that winch in my head tells me I ought to do. And she is not after my, she's not in here for our mutual benefit, I'll tell you. She is in here to survive. Sometimes, I think my brain would like to kill me and live on its own, you know. And I heard a speaker say one time, he said, the only reason my brain keeps my body is for transportation. Anna. So there's an alarm that goes off when I say should. I looked at the way we had rewritten these traditions, and I realized that should is in there in some places, and about, I don't know what other word to put in there. Ought is just semantics. It's the same thing, you know. And I can't say I really do. All I can tell you is I'm trying. You know, it's the direction I'm pointing in. What I do to meet my spiritual needs is I go to Al-Anon. And I go religiously to Al-Anon. I grew up in a family that went to church on Sundays in the summer when it rained. I mean, we went to church a lot. We went 2-3 times a week to church. I didn't find the God of my understanding there. I did not. I found the God of my understanding in Al-Anon. That's what I do to meet my spiritual needs. Every once in a while, I have a hankering, a need to go to church. And there's a church in Dallas that I go to, and it's not the church I grew up in. It's another church. The last time I went, I had been needing to go for a couple of weeks, and I don't know what that was about, except I knew I had to honor it, and I took myself to church one Sunday. I cried through the whole thing. Every time they sang, I cried. Every time they prayed, I cried. I just cried and cried and cried. I didn't have to go again after that for a while. Well, I don't know what that was about, you know, but I was honoring my spiritual need at that point. Most mornings, I journal. I do some reading, some conference-approved stuff, some non-conference-approved stuff. 11th step stuff is what I think of it as. And I journal, and I'll write a letter to God, and sometimes I'll say, Dearest, and sometimes I'll say, My Creator, and sometimes I'll say, Listen up. and then I write, and I might write what I'm doing that day, and I might write how I'm feeling, I might write something that has occurred to me or whatever, but I write. I try to get the words out of my head. And then I write 3 lines at the end of that, and I do it every day, and it's one of the things that really helps me focus on my spiritual growth. The first thing I write is, I am. Those are the 2 most powerful words we can say about ourselves, are I am. And I write down something about me that I know is true, or something that I really, really want to believe is true about me. I am open and loving. I am enthusiastic about life. I'm glad you're God and I'm me. And I am. And the next line I write is, the truth is. And sometimes there's a truth. This morning I wrote, I forgot exactly what I wrote, but I wrote something about, a lot of times I don't know what I'm going to write till the pen writes. You know, a lot of times it just happens. And I think I wrote something like, I am living in the power of love or something like that. And then the truth was that came out after that was, the truth is, that's all there is. And then the last thing I write is, Spirit is telling me, and it can either be Spirit is telling me or my heart is telling me, or Spirit is saying or my heart is saying, and then I write down. That's the moment that I do 2 minutes of being quiet or 30 seconds of being quiet, and I see what I can hear. I listen for what I can hear. Most mornings it's something to the effect of carry on or all is well. I get that one a lot, all is well. And it's a way for me to go out into my day. All right, my friends, we have done good. We have 30 minutes. That is your 30 minutes in your group to either deal with these traditions. You can use the questions if you want to. You don't have to. You can talk about the traditions if you want. You can use the pink page or the yellow page or no page. But you have got 30 minutes. Lunch is 12 to 1:30. And then the big thing happens, which is the raffle at 1:30. So you don't want to miss that. Lunch, was it good? Good. And you got outside and got a little energy. Not going to feel like taking a nap, are you? This is not nap time. If you feel sleep coming over you, you are excused. You may go. You may go sit out there and go sleep if that's what you need to do. Is there anybody here who was not here this morning? All righty then. Are any of you new to this program? We have a newcomer in the back. Three. Well, these two were here this morning. I remember them. But you just came in. This is your early on. All right. I would encourage you to get at a table. Is there any table that's got empty chairs? Empty chairs up here, and you are welcome to come sit yourself down. Please do. And I appreciate the rest of you coming back. All right. We are at, for our last newcomer who came in, we speak a little language here called Alanese. And we understand what we're saying, but you might not, and that's okay. Most of us didn't understand when we got here either. Some of us still don't understand. It doesn't keep us from talking, though, does it? No. I'd like to share that with you. So I would suggest one more time that you listen for the ways we're alike instead of the ways we're different. Looking for the ways we're different will keep you separate and sicker longer. I think that there may be some more copies of this stuff showed up someplace. If you've got some, there's some more copies up here of the questions and the whole thing. So if you don't have one and you want to come get one, there's some up here that you can get. I'm going to keep talking while you're moving, though. Let me make sure I know what I'm doing. 2 to 3. Okay. We are at Tradition 8, which in my little book reads, healthy relationships are, for the most part, free and giving, but sometime may require special workers. Which means if I focus on being the best me through the steps and carrying out these traditions, my relationships stand a good chance of remaining free and giving. But it gets harder when there's more than just me in the relationship. If there are other people in the relationship, it often gets stopped someplace. There are no guarantees, and I'm so disappointed to know that. I really wanted a guarantee about, and you know, I love those promises because I always like the always and never things. You know, if you do this, this will always happen. If you don't do this, this will never happen. But there aren't any guarantees, and stuff happens. Some years ago, almost a little more than 16 years ago to be exact, they have a birthday coming up, that's how I remember. My daughter, at the ripe old age of 18, got pregnant and wasn't married and was actually in a slippery place with slippery people, and it was kind of a scary thing. I kind of suspected how my mother might react, so I didn't tell her for a while. And we didn't live where she lived, so she couldn't see my daughter, and she didn't have to know. And I waited till my daughter was about, 5 months pregnant. For I mentioned it to my mother that she was pregnant. And my mother reacted pretty much the way I thought she'd react. She gasped, as she used to do with me, and then just held her breath. And the next morning she called me, and she was still crying. She'd been crying all night long. And she said, "I don't know how you stand this. How can you sleep when this is going on?" He was just wailing. And she said, "You know this will kill your grandmother when she finds out." And I need to tell you that about 2 months later, my grandmother died, and my sister happened to be with me when it happened. And when Mom called to tell us, my sister said, "You don't suppose she told her?" You know, and that was Mama's way of saying if she really had to think about it hard, it would kill her. But she couldn't talk about her. She had to make it about my grandmother. Now, when I called my dad and I told my dad what happened, my dad said was, "Wow, that's kind of big, isn't it?" And I said, "Yeah, Dad, it is." And he said, "What can I do to help you?" And I said, "Daddy, you can explain to me how you got that reaction. Because I'd really like to know how you did that." He said, "I have raised 9 children, and I have learned that stuff happens. And anything can happen to any of them, and acting surprised will just make you crazy." What? Oh, my God. Stuff happens. Sometimes we can't work out stuff between us. We just can't. Hard as we may try, much as we may want to, we simply can't do it. Whether it's a love relationship or a friendship or even with my kids, there were times when we just couldn't work it out. Everybody is firmly entrenched in their place, and there isn't anybody changing their mind, and nobody can see the other person's side. Just can't let go. Just can't let go. And that's a time we have to talk to someone. A safe, healthy, objective third party, like, I don't know, maybe your sponsor. Or even a professional to help us through the stuff. Sometimes we have to talk to that person by ourselves, and sometimes we have to go as a relationship to talk about it. Like I've told you this morning, I'm blessed with some wonderful sponsees. And one of the things I've learned in dealing with them is I want to be a safe place for them to come when they're having trouble with one of the other sponsees. I have to be able to be objective enough that I'm not going to take sides when they're having issues between them. We have had instances where they have come together to talk to me about something they can't work out. When one of them comes to me and says, "Do you know what she's doing? She's done blah, 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 blah." The minute they start with, "Do you know what she's," I go, "Wait." Wait, that sounds like something she should be telling me, not you should be telling me. They tell them the same thing I tell my grandchildren. No tattletaling, please. And I work, it's not hard work, actually, because I, you know what I want for each of them is I want the highest and best for each of them, however that plays out. And they're the only people who know what's highest and best in their lives, and I got to trust them to live their lives. So I will walk through it with them if they want me to walk through with them. Sometimes they'll talk to each other, talk to this one about this one, before somebody in the circle comes to talk to me about what's happening, you know. But I don't go in there and say, "Are you doing..." I don't do it. It's not my place. I can be a special worker if I need to be a special worker, though. Sometimes it's better to hire a travel agent than let one partner assume all the responsibility. And it's always better to have someone else come clean your house. That's my personal opinion. The year of cancer, the year I did cancer, my dad said, "I can't be there with you, but what can I do to support you?" And I said, "I'll tell you one thing I'm not going to do this year is clean the house. It ain't going to happen." And Daddy said, "Well, I can handle that. I can send you money and you can hire somebody to clean the house." Well, she's still cleaning my house, and that's been 20 years later. And I tell everybody, my best friend April cleans my house. And April said to me one day, she said, "If we're best friends, when are you going to clean my house?" And I said, "Because we are best friends, I won't clean your house." And she's a member of my family, April is. The same way I may have to employ special workers, counselors and doctors, etc., to help me with Tradition 7, where I am responsible for taking care of myself, it's reinforcement that I can't be all things in a relationship. and neither does anyone else. Do I sound like an expert on things? Why? Is my security at risk? Is fear triggered? I said this a while ago to somebody else. One of the biggest tools I've gotten in Al-Anon is I don't know. I always thought before I got here that I had to know. I needed to know the answer to things. You know, it was one of my Al-Anon things about, well, someone's got to know, and it's nasty work, but I'll have to do it, you know. My sponsor said, you know what, you'll find it a lot freer to just say, I don't know, when you don't know. Because, you know, in my diseasiness, I'll make stuff up. And I can say it with such authority that you'll believe me. And I am making it up. I catch myself today sometimes when I think, I got a good story that goes with that one. Let me tell you this story. And I realize I'm telling you a story. I'm just making stuff up. Why do I feel like I have to be an expert? Why can't I let somebody else know, you know? Are there problems in my relationships that we aren't talking about? Why is that? One of my AA gurus, and I have three of them, I think of them as my E.F. Huttons. When they talk, I listen, is Bob Bazance of St. Paul, Minnesota. Bob talks about how we get with our sponsors, but it's how we get, and, you know, we have the same relationship with them we have with everybody else. It's just to different degrees. And that there get to be areas that you can't talk about and you don't talk about. And it happens in relationships where this area is roped off. We just don't talk about that. One of the things we just don't talk about that I'll get to in a little bit in a lot of my Al-Anon relationships is we don't talk about politics. And we don't talk about religion. It is a surefire way to get a resentment. Is to start talking about those two things. But at home in my life, my husband's weight, his eating patterns, or something we can't talk about anymore. I have way too many feelings about it, and he doesn't have enough. And so I do my thing while I say, just here, I'll give you some. I'll give you some stuff to feel about, you know, I'll give it to you. But we don't talk about it, and I know why we don't talk about it. It's not a safe place. It's not a place where we can be unemotional about talking about those things. You know, what happens to me, I'll talk about it tonight in my story. What happens to me when I get afraid is when I chase the fears all the way to their baseline, the baseline for me is I'm afraid I'm not enough. I'm afraid I can't take care of myself. I'm afraid you have to do these certain things or be this certain thing or be this certain place or I'll die because I can't do it by myself. It doesn't sound rational, but I'm not telling you my fears are rational. I'm telling you my fears are, for the most part, totally irrational. Do you know that fear is not a defect of character? Fear is a good thing. Fear is the thing that makes you jump out from in front of that truck that's coming your way. Fear's the thing that will, when you find a lump, will tell you it's time to go do something about the lump. My disease is I'm afraid of being afraid. Feeling afraid paralyzes me. Fear overwhelms me. It takes over my life. And I will do anything to keep from being afraid because I lose myself in the fear. My husband's eating habits and the result of what's happening in his health feel life-threatening to me. It's not my life that's on the line, it's his life on the line. But that's how it feels to me, which is why that's a place we can't talk about, because I am way too emotional about it, and I know it. We just don't go there. We don't talk about, in my marriage, we don't talk about how he feels about his daughter living in Australia. He has, as far as he goes, having feelings, he probably has his biggest feelings about her being so far away and that he doesn't get to see her but maybe once a year and she's his only child. He doesn't talk about that. And I understand that that's not a place he can go, and I don't go poking around in there. It's not mine to go meddling in. But in some of my other relationships, there may be a thing where I sponsor this gal that I've sponsored since she was a senior in high school, and she's about 34, 35 right now, I think. And Hallie had a baby that died in the labor room, a 9-pound baby that died in the labor room. And she's pregnant again, so you keep her in her prayers. She's going to deliver the end of March. Yes! and it's going to be a healthy boy. We know it's a healthy boy. But you know, Hallie and I went through a period of time when we couldn't talk about Ethan, about the first baby, because it was too much. I had to wait for her to be ready to talk about it. It was not something that it was mine to talk about. It wasn't time to talk about, and I had to give her the space to get to it when she could get to it. And now, and she sent me a picture. The nurses had taken a picture of the baby, and I have a picture of Ethan, and we can talk about that. We can talk all about it now, but it took a while for it to be time, and it wasn't my time. Do I charge others a price for being in a relationship with me? What is it? Do you have to be on time, or I won't be in this relationship with you? If you don't care enough to get here on time, do I allow myself the joy of helping others for fun and for free? Yes, indeed I do. I had that engraved inside my husband's wedding band when we got married. For fun and for free, forever. However long ever lasts, you know. You know, some of my forever relationships have lasted a week and a half. I'm pretty sure forever is a lot longer this time. Well, it's 11 years so far, but... Who or what was my role model for a healthy relationship? Well, healthy kind of narrows it down. It's pretty much been people since I've been in the program. What I've discovered is that there isn't just one person who's... You know, my sponsor some years ago, before she passed, she said... we knew she was sick, and we knew that what was going to happen, and she was encouraging me, you know, for another sponsor. Not saying you got to do it right now, but she was sort of giving me her blessing, you know, before she passed. And she said, you know, you've been in this program long enough that you could probably just have a committee, if you want a committee. You can just pick this person for this, and this person for this, and this person for this. And I said, and then she laughed, you know. I said, we both know that isn't going to work, you know. I need one person, you know. But as far as healthy relationships, I like what this one does. I like what this one does with a spouse. I like what this one does, how some things they do with friendships, this other person. And, you know, I've sort of picked around to see what looks healthy to me. One of the things that I admire, because alcoholism is a deadly disease, there are very few people, couples, who come in this program together and remain together in recovery. Because it means the complete destruction of their original relationship, and it means the building of a new relationship. And that ain't easy. It's darn near impossible, as a matter of fact. There's sometimes been so much destruction that it can't be done. I have watched, we have a good number of those people in my area, and I've watched those people, and I've watched them go through a process of evolvement, where when I first came in 20-some-odd years ago, to hear them talk, especially as a couple, everything was fine, life was great. We're both in recovery, and life is great. And then when I got to be, I was married when I first came in, and then I got to be single, and I'd hang out with them like a single woman, hanging out with the girls, you know, and I'd hear the truth about what was really going on in those relationships, and things were not fine. Things were not fine at all. And I'd think, ooh, I don't want to have a relationship like that. I don't want that happening. Well, I've watched them, and, you know, I've watched them stand still and go through a lot of trash to get to a relationship that's better than anything they ever dreamed of. But it took going through the trashy part. Do I ask for and graciously accept help when I need it? You know, that is one of the places where I still continue to have some... There's a line in the big book that talks about it. You know, what is the first thing I do when I'm in trouble? I ask God for help. But then it says you have to listen for the answer. And you have to do the action. Asking for help is only half of it. It's a spiritual game. Asking for help and then staring at the place you think it ought to come from, you know, is just a spiritual game. Accepting the help when it comes, no matter what it looks like. My journey in Al-Anon has been the journey from yeah, but to thank you. Yeah, but is what I do to keep us separate. Yeah, 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 we got a lot of the same words, but you don't understand what it's like in my life. Yeah, 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 I hear you, but, and it's a very people-pleasing, I don't agree with you. today I'm to the place where I can say thank you for most of that stuff, for most of the stuff that comes along. Maybe not the first moment, but later on I can say that. And when the help comes from a direction I don't expect, this morning I went out walking in the fog, and sometimes before I get ready to talk, I'll say to God in my head, you know what? If you are not there today representing yourself, we are both screwed, you know. And this morning I'm walking around talking to God, and I look down on the sidewalk, and there wasn't a penny, there was a quarter. And it was like God went, whoa! You know, I am like big time. I went, okay, good, got it. Got it. Thank you. How do I feel when a partner tells me he or she needs help with our relationship? I've taken it very personally at some point. But not so much anymore. I'm glad somebody will come and say, I'm having difficulty with this, and I'm going to ask for some help. I would much rather have somebody do that and demonstrate that they want to stay in the relationship than just disappear without knowing what's going on. Do I try to be super mom, super secretary, superman, super whatever by taking on too much? Oh, never. Tradition 9, a healthy relationship should be flexible in its organization. And about my first year in the program, I heard an AA talking about the third step. And if you're fairly new in this program, and even if you're not, I would strongly encourage you to go to open AA meetings, to speaker meetings. The way I found out about the disease of alcoholism was to listen to alcoholics talk about themselves. When the people I love who have alcoholism, when they talk, the only thing I can hear is my own pain. I can't hear the difference between the person and the disease. Open AA meetings were some of the biggest gifts I ever got. Anyway, she said that she had read the third step, which basically says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. She said what she heard was, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God when we understood him. Not as we understood him. Huge revelation for me. I remember where I was sitting when she said that, because what I thought that's what it said too. I realized at that moment or shortly thereafter that I was that way in every single relationship I was in. I wanted to know what you tell me what you're going to do, and I'll do all the rest to make this relationship look the way I think it needs to look, so I'll be okay, so I'll be undisturbed, so my world will have the appearance I think it needs to have. It's a little bit of a control issue, as well as a almost total inability to hold people responsible for their own behavior. In my diseasiness, and that's the way I think of my disease of alcoholism, it's a diseasiness. In my diseasiness, it's easier for things to be black and white. You do this, I do that. An added benefit to this approach is that it makes easier to assign blame when things go amiss. I would like for us, to make the rules about how things are going to be and who's going to do what, and we, read I, don't have to think about it again. And we, read you, do what you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do it. And it all comes out even and fair. Well, turns out even is relative, you know. And fair is a weather term and has little or nothing to do with life, actually. The Texas State, the State Fair of Texas is in Dallas in late September every year, and it's a big line in our meetings when someone says, but it's not fair, and they go, right, the fair is the end of September. Right. Apparently, the rules are made to be broken, and people never are going to get where I think they ought to be and stay there, which is what I always wanted them to do. Just get where you're going to be and stay there. They keep moving around, and stuff happens, you know. Most of the time today, I just need to do my part. Whatever we've agreed to, or whatever I've been doing anyway in the relationship. But sometimes, like I said, stuff happens. Sometimes my part means doing something different. I get so focused on keeping it even, getting in a rut and staying in a rut, that I have a hard time being present in the relationship. And this means I have to be present in the relationship. Isn't it lovely? I have to do something more than my usual or something the other person usually does, and sometimes my part means letting go of something I think I need to hold on to. My relationship with my grown children and my grandchildren. For the last 6.5 years, I've taken care of the grandchildren. Madison was not quite 5 months old. The first day I got her to take care of her is her daycare. And the baby was four last October now. The two oldest ones, who are 8 months apart, Tristan and Madison, my daughter had two sons, my son had two daughters. They had sense enough to do it within 3 years so I could actually do this thing. The oldest two have left me this year. Gone to public schools in their neighborhoods. One of them lives 40 miles away from me this way, the other one lives 30 miles away from me in the other way, and I don't get to see them every day. And I might get to see them once a month, and that's all I'm getting to see them. And I have had a physical reaction to letting go of those children. You know, God gives you teenagers to get you ready to let them go. That's what that's about, you know. It's hard to look at that nasty thing doing the thing they're doing and remember the darling little child you had one time. You know, God makes them precious in the beginning, so you just fall in love and you'll do anything. And then they turn into teenagers, and holy God, you know, you can't get them out of there fast enough. I'm ready, God. Take them. I'm ready. Well, these children are not teenagers, and besides, I've learned to love teenagers since I don't have any anymore. Other people's teenagers are much more preferable to your own. My phone answering machine at home had two messages from Madison that she had called and left for me. Mimi, this is Madison. And I saved them for months and months and months and months because I couldn't erase them. I needed to hear her. I needed her to be there. And about a month ago, my husband came home one day and he went, all the messages have been erased. I said, yep, I'm finally ready. You know, I'm finally ready to let her go and be a big first grader and do what she needs to do, and it's okay. But I wasn't ready when she left. It took me a while longer. It's my part, and I have to be flexible in that. Am I flexible in my relationships? You know, there's a difference between being flexible and being easy. Well, not always. No, that's right. A lot more flexible these days than I am easy. Used to be the other way around. Why are acceptance and freedom vital to this tradition? How important is the awareness of my own abilities and limitations in relationships? Are responsibilities clearly defined in my relationships? Who decided? Is it necessary? You know, it is sort of necessary in some of my relationships that we have an idea of who's doing what. Now, I've had some friendships and lost some friendships. Some friendships have ended. I don't like the lost word. Friendships have ended because I was told I couldn't do my part to be a good friend. I had a dear friend for a long, long time who said, you know, I'm tired of being the person who always calls. I'm tired of being the person who always makes the first move in this relationship. I'm tired of doing that. And I think it's just better if we don't try to be good friends because you can't do your part. Well, I beat myself up for months about that. And I whined to my sponsor, and I tried to think of everything I could do to make nice to her. And then I tried to do, you know, to be different in my other relationships and call those people and la-la-la-la and la-la-la-la and do all that stuff that she said I should be doing. And I've discovered it's not the kind of friend I am. And if that's a thing for you, it's probably better that we don't get to be really close friends, because I'm not going to do it. I'm not a sponsor who calls around and checks up on my sponsorees. The phone is still to me an instrument of torture. I don't use it unless I'm in trouble, you know. I'm not a chit-chatty person. Yeah, I know you find that hard to believe, but I'm not. And it's another one of those places where, you know, my program today, what I've done is I've taken a lot of other people's stuff and tried it on to see if it fit me. And it doesn't. Some stuff doesn't fit me. Some stuff I can alter to be mine if it needed to be altered, and some stuff just isn't mine. And that just isn't mine, and I don't beat myself up about that anymore. That's part of being flexible. Where am I in the process of learning how and when to step aside gracefully when I begin to overstep my bounds? You know, it's another place where I didn't know until I did it. And I know today when I'm overstepping my bounds. Today it's more by how I feel than how they react. It used to be I had to watch them to see how they were reacting to see if I was over the line. But I really have a pretty good internal gauge these days of when I'm doing something that somebody else is to do. When I am attempting to force an issue. You know what happens in recovery is you get a lower threshold of discomfort. It doesn't take long for my old behavior to make me uncomfortable. I used to put up with a lot more unacceptable behavior from myself than I do these days. And it isn't that I'm so righteous or doing so good. It just makes me uncomfortable. And I still pretty much have the same goal. I don't want to be uncomfortable, you know. What do I do when others' actions are repeatedly unacceptable? When I first came to Al-Anon and I told them what was happening in my marriage, they said, that is unacceptable. And I beat myself up for months and months and months because it didn't seem so bad to me. I'd certainly lived in worse. And I thought, God, you're so stupid. But, of course, that's the way I talked to myself a lot in those days. You're so stupid. You can't even figure out what's acceptable and unacceptable. And you can't get yourself out of it. As time went past, it became unacceptable. It got to the place where I didn't deserve to be treated like that. It got to the place where it's not how I wanted to live my life. Here I'm going to talk about this one more time. Those are the places where I have to report my feelings to other people. I am not good at all at when you did blah, 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 it made me feel blah, 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 blah. Because that is not the truth. They can't make me feel anyway. I'm going to feel how I'm going to feel. If I'm going to feel less than, if I'm going to feel abandoned or however I'm going to feel, it's already in here. Somebody else's behavior just kicks it off, but they didn't make me do that. It's already in here. You can't create a feeling I don't have. What I do is I say, I have a really strong reaction to this kind of behavior. When this kind of behavior goes on around me, this is how I feel. It's not about them. It's about me. I have a gal I sponsored for a long time who was one of the angriest human beings you have ever met in your life. I watched her one time after a meeting drive her car up on the curb at somebody. She did, honest to God. She vroom, right up on, she was just aiming for him. Had him up on the curb, pinned almost. She didn't get that close, but I'm standing there with my mouth open going, oh, Donnell, we need to talk. But not now. Wait till you calm down a little and get out of the car and then we'll talk. I had an issue with angry people. I came to Al-Anon and I had in a lot of years allowed myself to be angry, except at my children. My children caught the brunt of my rage. But I didn't get mad at anybody else. They just hurt my feelings. I turned it all on the inside. And so God sent me, God was there when Donnell came because I could hear what Donnell was saying. And she had heard me talk in meetings, and she said, I know you have problems with anger. Yes, I do. And she said, I make you a promise that I will be honest with you about my anger from the beginning. And I said, that's a deal. We can do this then. She'd call me on the phone, and she would be just screaming. She was so mad. And she would start the conversation off with, I'm not angry at you. And I'd go, okay. Got it. Now we can talk about whatever you're angry about. And, you know, she and I worked together for years and years, and somewhere in the process of dealing with Donnell and her honesty, I learned to be angry myself. And when I learned to not be afraid of my anger, I wasn't afraid of hers anymore. But I needed somebody to stand still and work that out with me. And I said to her, I got to tell you that this is a painful thing for me. And she said, I understand. She said, I really don't like being this angry all the time either. I said, okay. And sometimes she'd call me up and tell me what they were doing and how they were picking on her. And I finally, it's like a sponsor I had one time who used to call me up and say she was going to commit suicide. That was going to be the night she was going to commit suicide. And I finally said to her one time, you know what, as long as suicide is a viable option for you, we can't work together. And she was getting professional help, which because the first thing I do when somebody's threatening suicide. But I said, as long as that's a viable option, we can't work together. If we're going to work together, you're going to have to give up the idea of suicide. That is not acceptable anymore. I listened to it for, you know, years probably before I finally said it's not acceptable anymore. She doesn't talk about suicide anymore. Thank you, God. All right. Tradition 10, I express no opinions on outside issues. Hence, my name ought never be drawn into public controversy. Okay, truthfully, I rarely express opinions on outside issues, and so rarely is my name drawn into public or private controversy. God knows I have opinions, which is just another word for judgments. This tradition is an ideal to strive for, and I'm much better at it than I used to be. I really, most of the time, can keep what's going on in my head from coming out of my mouth. Sometimes I can't, but most of the time I can. Early on, I was impressed, greatly impressed, with how well this tradition works at our group level in Al-Anon. Not only did we not talk about our professions, religions, outside publications, other 12-step programs, or politics in meetings, we didn't talk about each other behind each other's back. I have been blessed to be in a home group where gossip has not been an issue until recently. And recently, it's become an issue. One of the things that's happened is because prayers are answered, I think, we have a good many alcoholics who are coming into Al-Anon, which is where they all belong. I don't know how they go to business meetings with each other without coming to an Al-Anon meeting. I really don't. I think they're remarkable that they haven't killed each other, you know, but without Al-Anon, I really do. But for a long time, there still is in a lot of areas, and we're working through a process here. A lot of animosity between AA, particularly, I don't mean to single us out, girls, but it's particularly between AA women and Al-Anon women. There tends to be some real fear, I think more on an AA woman's part than there is on an Al-Anon woman's part. But there tends to be a lot of judgment on an Al-Anon woman's part. And we have to work that stuff out, girls, because we're all the same. You scratch. There's some stories up here I could tell you about some of these people up here. There are a couple of these Al-Anon women up here. I walked in when I was new and heard them already telling their stories, and I could have sworn they were alcoholic. And they did it stone cold sober, which is really scary when you find out what they did. Stone cold sober. Not blacked out or anything. They knew exactly what they were doing. But what's happened is, for whatever reason, the women who are coming to us from our particular AA group, and we meet in the same place with the AAs, they meet on one side, we meet on the other side, for whatever reason, the women over there on the other side, and maybe it's part of the process of coming to Al-Anon, I don't know what the deal is, but we're having trouble with them gossiping outside of the meetings about what somebody said in the meeting. You know, most Al-Anon groups, I remember when this first became an issue, that's how old I am, we have built about 10 minutes worth of ways in the beginning of the meeting to tell alcoholics not to say they're alcoholic in the meeting. Don't say it. Don't say it this way. Don't say it that way. We don't talk about this or this or this or being in another 12-step program. Or we keep the focus on us and not on the alcoholic. We do this whole thing about telling them how they don't talk about being alcoholic. And they don't mind. They don't. They never minded us. I don't know why you think they'd mind us now. They don't mind. A lot of times they're just not there to hear it, which is pretty much the way it always was. You know, they're just not there to hear it. Well, there's no malicious intent on anybody's part. There's no malicious intent. We're not, you know, we're welcome. I love having alcoholics come into our meetings. I've watched a number of them make miraculous recoveries in there. After 10, 12, 15 years in AA, they come into Al-Anon and they have a life-changing experience. And sometimes they have to go to 10 or 12 or 15 years of AA to get well enough to come to Al-Anon. I don't know why that is, but that's the way it is. Or maybe to get sick enough to come. Maybe that's the thing. I don't know. I am thrilled that they're coming because I think that everybody's recovery will be strengthened by that. What's happened, though, with the gossip is I noticed that at our last group conscience meeting that I couldn't go to. Man, I was so disappointed. But somebody called me when they got home. They went, "Woo, you missed a good one." Rats, I said, "What happened?" They said, "Can't tell you. You weren't there." Nothing makes me crazier. I have this bad FMMS disease, you know, afraid might miss something. So I try to be everywhere if it's at all possible, and I couldn't be there that night. So, but I saw it up on the board that we were going to talk about gossip because it's become an issue in my group. And so now they spent another 15 minutes at group conscience trying to find another way to tell alcoholics not to say they're alcoholics and keep their mouth shut outside the meeting. Instead of going to the person, you know, my daughter gave me a very powerful tool one time. She said, I said, you know, confrontation is just not something we Al-Anons do very well. We don't want to upset anybody. Unless we want to upset them. We don't want to upset anybody else. She said, Mom, you don't confront the person, you confront the issue. It's not about the person, it's about the issue. Talk about the issue. Oh, right, we keep the focus on us, right? Right. Principles above personalities. Right. How it escapes me. And that has been such a wonderful thing because we talked about this last night too. I have very little qualms about going up to somebody after a meeting and saying, we are so glad you're here. This obviously is a place you need to be. And because we want this to be Al-Anon for you and for us, what we do in here is we ask you to come as a newcomer. We share from our experience, strength, and hope, and ours is derived from living with the effects of alcoholism. And it's a different experience, and it calls for a different interpretation. Now, that takes a huge, huge bit of humility to walk into an Al-Anon room with them after you've got 5 or 6 or 7 or 15 years in another 12-step program and act like you don't. But the truth is you don't. You're a newcomer in that program. And if you want the recovery that's in there, that's where you got to start from. If you don't start from there, you're not going to get it. Because if you don't do what we did, you're not going to get what we got. I want Al-Anon to stay Al-Anon. I want them to have the best shot at it they can get at it. You know, we get those cute things in there that go, "Hi, my name's Susan, and I'm really glad to be here." Yeah, you didn't blow that too much, Susan, but that's okay. And, you know, the truth is that outside the meeting, we don't talk about those things much anyway. This little group that meets at my house on Wednesday nights, 6:30 to 7:30 is dinner. Bring your own if you want to chat. And then the meeting's from 7:30 to 8:30. And there were people sitting at dinner the other night who brought their own dinner. And politics started. And by the time the meeting was over, one of the little gals was standing over there saying, "I really need to talk to you." So we had to go back in the bedroom, and she had to say, "You know, when that politics starts," she said, "I get really uncomfortable. I feel differently from most everybody else in the room. And I feel, I take it all personally." And I said, "Oh, good time for you to speak up. You're going to have to speak up. You're going to have to say." She wanted me to tell them, "Don't talk about politics anymore." I said, "You're going to have to speak up and say, it makes me very uncomfortable. I feel different from you again. And I don't want to be different from you. And it's a place we don't agree. And I need to tell you, it makes me very uncomfortable." She hasn't done it yet, but my money's on her. I'll bet you at some point she will. The idea that what others say is 99 times out of 100 their opinion and not the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help me, and doesn't have to be argued to the death about, was a big aha for me. Knowing how I feel and think about my life is important enough to speak up about, knowing that has been critical to my recovery. So I do voice my opinions, which hopefully is my feelings tempered with my thoughts or vice versa, in appropriate places like group conscience meetings and in relationships when I can keep the focus on me and not on anyone or anything else. It's reporting. It's been a very long time since someone said, "I heard what you said about me and it really hurt." And I am so grateful for that. I was in an administrative meeting back when I had my big long job, and most of the people left after the meeting except my boss, and I was still there doing something else, and someone else was there, and my boss decided that she needed to talk about one of the other administrators. And I was immediately uncomfortable. And I said to her, "You know what? This is a conversation that I don't need to be part of." And I excused myself and I left the room. I didn't stand and be part of it. Am I careful to keep confidences? If not, why not? You hear those horror stories about people who have shared a fist step and it comes back to haunt them somewhere along the way. Luckily, that happens very, very rarely. Am I publicly critical of others? How does controversy affect me physically, emotionally, and spiritually? Do I express opinions, thoughts, and feelings on inside issues? Don't know if you've ever heard Wayne B. talk, but Wayne is another AA. Wayne talks about his hula hoop. And he puts the hula hoop on, and he says, "Everything inside the hula hoop is my opinion, because it's about me. Everything outside the hula hoop is an outside issue. Anything that goes from here and beyond is an outside issue." How my children lead their lives today is an outside issue for me. But I do have to share about the inside issues. And one more time, I don't have to necessarily share them with the person I'm having the feelings with. I can share it with my sponsor. I had an incident happen probably 11 or 12 years ago, maybe longer than that, actually. Anyway, it was a woman in Al-Anon who had literally saved my life. She had literally saved my life. She'd put a lot of time and effort into helping me. And she told me when it started, she said, "The problem is I'm not going to know when to start," because I had asked her to please do this really big thing. And she said, I'd be happy to do that, but I won't. She said, "The problem is I'm not going to know when to stop." And we developed a not healthy relationship because I was very dependent on her, and she mothered me, which is not a healthy relationship for two grown women. But that's what happened. Now, I know she saved my life. What happens is when I'm not honest in relationships, if I don't tell you what's going on, or if I don't tell somebody and work out my issues, I put a brick between us. And the next thing happens, I put another brick, and another brick, and another brick, and another brick, till there's a wall there, and neither one of us can get over it, and the relationship is gone. Anyway, this woman told me, she quit speaking to me after, you know, how close we were and all this stuff, and I'm on her speed dial, and her kids consider me a sibling, and one day she quit speaking to me. She wasn't talking to me. And I confronted her. I went to her house, and I said, "I need to know what's going on. This is very uncomfortable. What's happening?" And she said, "Well, I've been seeing a counselor, and I've decided that you're a very angry person, and I've decided not to be around angry people anymore, so I'm not going to be around you anymore." It wasn't a deal where she was willing to change the relationship, where she was willing to work anything out. She was done. It was finished. It was over. And that was it. And she didn't want to talk to me anymore. And then one day, everything was fine. It seemed as if. And the next day, everything was not fine. Had never been able to tell her that I didn't want her to be my sponsor because she mothered me, so I let her assume she was my sponsor. I'd never been able to tell her about the things that were going on that weren't working for me. I couldn't ever say those things, and I allowed this relationship to turn into one of these kind of relationships because I didn't speak up for my inside issues. I talked to my sponsor. The problem is she's a woman with a lot of years of Al-Anon in my area. So I couldn't go to anybody and say, "I got to tell you what happened, what she said to me," because I'm not going to go around talking about her. I'm not going to do it. I talked to my, it forced me to finally go to the sponsor who ended up being my sponsor for the next 15 years, but it forced me to go to her and say, "You know, it's time. I really need you to be my sponsor," and this is what happened. And she said, "Oh, you know, she didn't mean it," because she loved her too. You know, she had no idea what was going on. It took another 3 years before I was able to write an inventory, and I was asked at the last minute to come speak at some little something over in Mississippi or something. And I still was carrying it. I was still trying to please her after all these years. I was still trying to say the right thing, be the right person, be in the right place, make it all better. I was still trying to do that. And I called my sponsor and I said, "You know, I wrote that inventory and I think there's a woman here who is willing to hear it." And it was somebody who didn't know her. And I did the inventory with that lady who didn't know her. and we were able to look at what my part was in the thing and walk across the street to the Gulf of Mexico and tear it up and throw it away. And I've been free of it since then. But I had to talk about what was going on inside of me, and it had to be the ears that could hear me instead of ears that already had judgments. Can I be wrong? I feel like Fonzie whenever I get to that word. You know, I want to go, rah, 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 rah. And that's a place I'm practicing these days, in saying to somebody I was wrong instead of I apologize, but saying I was wrong. What I did was wrong. Do I allow my decisions to be swayed by others' beliefs or judgments? I'll leave that one to you.